Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Arthur, Lonnie, Helene, Henry, Judd, Bubby and Zadie, Audrey. Good to see you guys. Okay. All right, while people are still logging in, if you want, we're on Chav Zayin Amud Beis on 27B. And I'm still working out logistics, but you can already just start looking at your calendars. God willing.
Nice.
Either Sunday, February 26th or March 5th, God willing, one of those two Sundays, I think would be ideal for us to have our Siyum, God willing, as Hashem, everything works out.
February
So,
26th sounds good.
okay, thanks. Well, I'll send out an email so I can get a hopefully all the responses collected, but that's certainly what
Sounds like somebody's birthday.
Okay, so very good, very good. So we find ourselves on 27B. Oh, so just an idea that I had. I know most of you folks are from what I understand, not on social media. But I was thinking it'd be nice, because if we're God willing about to finish a Masechta, it's always good to make a push for more of our friends to join us in this fulfilling endeavor. So I was thinking, actually, maybe we'll get some folks who are, from my circles as well, age range wise. We should have a whole range. Everyone in the community should be involved. So I wanted to put stuff on social media to kind of promote the class. I was thinking, it depends if you guys are savvy enough for this. I'll show you when I put one together. I wanted to do the days leading up to the CM to put on social media, kind of like photos of members of our class, with their name and then a bl and their name and then a blurb of just like what they liked about learning Gemara at Shul. So then that way, kind of puts a name to the face. People see like, oh, I see Audrey Wolfstreicher is in the class. I see Lonnie Keene is in the class. I see all the people who are in there. It'll encourage others to join. So that's something I'm thinking about. I guess the question is, if I send out a Google form and I ask you to attach a photo of yourself, if you feel confident that you're able to send that, I'll let you contemplate that in time. I could always just take a screenshot of everyone smiling here and crop out their photos. That's better. I'll figure it out. But again, putting stuff on the radar, because there's so many folks out there that like to get on social media and complain about things in the community. So I'm like, why can't we just create some positivity and promote all the good things that are happening? People should see that. Okay, so here we are. We're on Chav Zayin on the base. We're on 27B. We are on the third line, the Mishnah, all the way at the top. Just for what we should expect today, a little bit of a bird's eye view. First, we're going to have a brief discussion about selling a shul that serves a bigger population to a smaller population. Then I'll just do a general mute because I think it's background noise. Okay. So then we're going to have a little bit, this one's going to require a little bit more of our thinking hats, but it's definitely understandable. We're going to have a discussion about ribis, about collecting interest. So I know Judd, you're very interested in the financial transactional laws. So this will be a little bit of a Nezikin kind of topic. We'll be talking about ribis. And then we're going to have some discussion about one davening and if they need to relieve themselves, what the proper procedure is. And then finally, we're going to have start a discussion about various different Talmudic scholars. And they are going to tell us why they merited to live a long life. And they're going to list a number of hanhagos tovos, special practices that each of them had. I was just talking to someone at shul whose distant relative was like a very big Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Feivel Cohen. And they were going to have Lucis. They were going to have this whole gathering at Chosen Island in the Five Towns. And he was going to actually come to the party, but then the mashgiach there changed that night, and he was like makbid that if the mashgiach on site is not someone who I personally trained because he was very involved in this, then I'm not going to eat there. And you know, like no one, that's not something that anyone else could really be machmed on, but every gadol has their hakpadas. You know, like for instance, Rav Schechter, for, you know, reasonably so, he won't eat turkey. All right, we don't have the Masorah for him. So, you know, everyone's going to, every gadol is going to have their chumras that their community doesn't necessarily adopt. So we're going to see, what's going to be really fascinating is we're going to have some examples where one rabbi is going to say, if I recall correctly, that I always made a bracha before duchening, before reciting Birchas Kohanim. And we're all going to raise our eyebrows like, huh? What's so special about that? Like, don't all Kohanim make a blessing before the blessing of the Kohanim? So we'll see. It's going to be interesting to see what are considered a really good example just for the men here. Wearing a yarmulke, by the way. So, I mean, in observant circles, it's standard that a man wears a yarmulke. But in back in the day, wearing a head covering was originally a midas chasidus. It was originally a pious practice. So it's really fascinating to see how certain things were pious practices back in the day. And it's always interesting, by the way, because we have this concept of Yeridas Hadoros, the diminution of the generations, that with each ensuing generation that's further and further from the Torah being given at Sinai, we are, you know, but dust of at the feet of the previous generation. So it's interesting to see, though, how what were considered the pious practices of the previous generation are now the standard practice for the current generation. So how do we make sense of that? I don't have a clear answer, but that's some interesting food for thought we're going to have raised, God willing, at the end of this year. So without any further ado, let's jump on in to the Mishnah. Ein mochrin es shel rabin liyachid, nifnei shemo ridin oso mikdu shaso, divi Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir is of the opinion that we do not sell a shul that serves the masses to an individual because it decreases its level of sanctity. We'll explain what that means in the Gemara. Amar lo, the sages respond, in Cain, ak lo meir gadol ir katanam. We should never be able to sell a shul from a larger city to a smaller city. Now, it's not exactly clear what that means because, like, are they picking up the shul and carrying it to the next city? It might mean that it's a community from one city, it's taking over the other, but they're a smaller population, a smaller group of people. There's different understandings. But the Chacham reply, if we're willing to sell from one community to a smaller community, selling from the rabbin, the public, to an individual shouldn't be any different. So let's go into the Gemara and try to understand what is the nature of this dispute. So the Gemara starts off saying, well, Shaper Kamile Rabban Al Rai Meir. Nope, the Rabban are saying good. The sages have a good point, very compelling. So what would Rabbi Meir respond? Rabbi Meir, Meir Gedola, Leir Kitana, Meikar Kadisha, Ashtanami Kadisha, Kadisha, Meirami Yachid, Leika Kadusha. What's the distinction? When you sell from a bigger community to a smaller community, the shul is still a shul. It's still a Pesach Knesset where people are coming in and saying Dvar Mshev Kedusha. They're reciting Kaddish. They're saying Baruch Hu. There's Kriyas HaTorah that's going on. There's Kedusha being said. But when you sell from the public and you give it to an individual, even if the only thing he does is come in and it's just his personal prayer space, he wants his own personal prayer space, his own shul, right? Some people, they decide to commission a Torah, like, you know, sometime in their life. Apparently this guy, he went all out. He wanted to get a whole shul just for himself, right? He couldn't get along with anyone. That guy was taking his seat and he just, like, he had it with this politics and that kiddush and everything. So he just, you know, decided, I'm having my own shul. No one else comes here. Everything, I'll give the sermon. Everything's done according to me. So the issue is, that's very nice. He's more than welcome to do that. But one man you can't say Kaddish on your own. You can't say Baruch Hu on your own. You can't say Kedusha on your own. So that means this building is no longer being used for the same sanctified purposes as it originally was being used. That's what Rabbi Meir says is the issue specifically when they sell to a yachid, an individual. However, so what are the Rabbana going to respond? It's a good distinction, I think, right? So the Rabbana respond, Rabbanan, Iikala mechash ihai gavna, nami iikala mechash mishum berovam hadras melech. Well, if you're so concerned about Kedusha, isn't there also the consideration of berovam hadras melech? Very important concept, by the way, to know. We actually talked about berovam hadras melech earlier in the Masechta when we were still talking about the mitzvah of reading Megillah. And we noted that if you have a choice to hear the Megillah at a big minyan or at a small minyan, everyone should really be coming together to hear at one minyan in order to be yotzei the mitzvah. Barov ha'hadras mouth. The more people brings more glory to God. However, I mean, we did also note that, of course, if you go to a large minyan, where you are far less likely to be yotzei the mitzvah altogether because of potential noise at a larger minyan, then of course it's more ideal to go to a smaller minyan where you are more likely to be yotzei the mitzvah. The inka makom laharich. We'll leave that. So the chacham say we should be bringing brovim hadras melachin. And you should say, according to you, Rabbi Meir, selling from a larger shul, a larger community to a smaller community, also should be considered a downgrade because it's a lack of Barov HaHadras Melech. There's less glory being given to God in this building because there are less people who are showing up to shul. So that's the claim of the Chachamim. I mean, again, Lefinius Daiti, I hear Rabbi Meir's distinction at the same time. I'm very sympathetic because there is a concrete difference between being able to say certain prayers or not versus saying the same exact prayers just with extra bodies in the room. So, okay, that's the machlokes. That's the
Rabbi.
Yes, Phyllis.
How about the fact that there might be a larger majority of people at a smaller place who are more sincere in their davening?
Yeah, I don't want to start going now with a measuring stick trying to figure out who counts as what.
It doesn't seem right that numbers are more important than
100%.
The essence.
100%. Clearly, it's clear to me, and based on our discussion about the Megillah, and it pertains to prayer in general, if you could go to a smaller minyan where they're not talking and it's a better, you could have more kavana. I believe that clearly trumps going to where there's more people, but there's more talking and more disturbance. Happens to be, it doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes larger minions are actually the more well-behaved, but again, we're just talking a theoretical over here. Okay, going to the next Mishnah. See, we already accomplished a Mishnah tonight. Next one. Okay. Next one is, we're going to be talking about, selling a shul once more. Ein mochrim bisak neses ela al tenai shemir to yachziru divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says that anytime you sell a shul, there is supposed to be a built-in stipulation that if the original seller regrets their decision to sell the shul and they want to reclaim it, they will return the money and then they will get their shul back. That's a built-in stipulation, according to Rabbi Meir. The Chachamim over them, I'm just gonna do a general mute. Okay. The Chachamim over them, Mocher noso mi mecher olam, chutz mi arba dvarm, the merchot of the worst view that's be a little based on mine. One is allowed to sell, and it's an absolute sale. The seller cannot come back and try to buy it back. However, it just can't be sold for purposes which are not just simply non-sacred, but disrespectful to the status of what the shul once was. And that would be, what would be considered undignified if it's a bathhouse, if it's made for tanning purposes, not for people tanning, that would also probably be a problem, tanning hides. Litvila besamayim for immersion, bathing, or for laundering. So any of those purposes would be inappropriate. Therefore, the shul cannot be sold for those purposes. However, Rabbi Yehuda has a great solution. Rabbi Yehuda omer, mocher notzal l'shem chatzer, halakech mashir tiyatze. Look, we don't discuss what happens in the shul afterwards. You're selling the shul to the guy, and you know what? Let the guy decide what he wants to do with it afterwards. All right? So you're not saying, I'm selling the shul so it could be used as a bathhouse. Don't talk about it. The guy will decide what he wants to do later. You're not selling it so it could become a bathhouse. You're selling it to the guy who may then possibly decide to proceed and turn it into a bathhouse. But then that's his decision at that point. That's what Rabbi Yehuda says. Okay. Now, sorry, just got a little warm in here. I'm just going to open up the window. Okay. All right, back into the Gemara. Here we go. So if you recall, Rabbi Meir says that, all right, we're going to have two individuals here. I mean, the individuals might be representing parties as opposed to single individuals, but just to make the case easier. Reuven sells a shul to Shimon, okay? That's what's happening. Reuven can request the shul back at any time, according to Rabbi Meir, right? What's the issue? Rabbi Meir, Hechi Dariba, Habila Rivas. How can Reuven, how can Shimon, who buys the shul from Reuven, okay? Reuven sells shul, have an interest for sharing. Reuven sells the shul to Shimon. Shimon now is using the shul. So the issue is Shimon bought the shul for, let's say, $1 million, $2 million. Let's go with $1 million. Just go with that. if the shul costs $1 million, right? So then what happens is Shimon not only gets $1 million back from Reuven when Reuven requests the shul back, what else does he get? He got 3 months of free rent at the shul because he's getting that exact $1 million back plus all the time that he got to use it for his own purposes, right? People show out, I'm sure, significant money to rent shuls for their celebrations and random events. 3 months of free rent at this building, that's not too bad. So the issue is that's ribis, that's interest. Because he gave, it's basically, what did he do in the interim? Essentially what he did was he gave a loan to the seller, to Reuven, and then he gets back from Reuven the $1 million, same amount of money, plus the rent on top of that. That is essentially the 3 months rent, which is, I'm sure if you have the assessors, they can figure out precisely what that would cost to rent for 3 months. That has monetary value. That constitutes ribis, interest. So, right, just for those writing down terms, ribis is interest. I'm not going to keep translating that. So just good. Ribis is interest. Okay. And he's saying
the Gemara doesn't discuss something that concerns me. It's not a sale if you have a right to get it back.
So it would, okay. So we're going to actually see in the continuation of the Gemara momentarily that this is like, the Gemara acknowledges that this isn't quite your average case of ribis, which that's the, okay, so let's get to it. That might be the answer of the Gemara. Amar Rav Yochanan, right? Meir b'shitas Rav Yehuda Amra. So Amar tzad echa b'ribis mutter. Zadie, I think this is what you're a little bit uncomfortable with, is the fact that, well, this was a sale, and there's no, you know, it's not like Reuven is guaranteed to ask for the shul back, because give the money back. This was a sale after all. So it's only in the event that Reuven does demand the shul back and gives the money back, incidentally, it becomes ribis. But that's not the plan from the outset. So the question is, if you didn't, right, as a result, in the end of the day, it turns out that it was a ribis arrangement. But if that was not, if our plan was to make a sale and not to make an interest arrangement from the outset, but in the end of the day, it does result in interest, do we call this a ribis arrangement? That's the question.
So, but what I'm looking at is what constitutes ownership. If you buy something, you own it. And how can you own it if you might have to give it back on the demand of the seller?
So we have a similar concept also. I think we talked about this when we learned Makos a while back. Maybe in the second paragraph came up, we're talking about certain ancestral property, ancestral land is also under certain circumstances. I think, we talked about it here as well. We talked about in a walled city, I believe, one can sell their place in a walled city, but then they would have a right to reclaim it. Maybe it was within a year, if I'm not mistaken. So there is such an idea where it's a sale, but I have a schus, I have a right to demand reclaiming. So it's not that the original acquisition is nullified retroactively. That acquisition took place. It's just that I have the right to demand a reverse acquisition.
Rella, is this akin to or a precedent for a het de iska?
Well, I mean, heterisk, of course, is very much relate. Oh, interesting. In order to, I mean, for investments in general, I mean, that's what heterisk is for. Is it addressing this specific case? I'm not sure if the heterisk is addressing this specific case, but generally, like, you know, if you want to make an investment or something, then that's kind of what the heterisk is operating on. But you're right. What Paul's bringing up is that there's a very complicated idea called a heterisk, which is basically a very ingenious halachic workaround to circumvent the laws of ribis, because in theory, anytime you invest in a company, what are you hoping for? Not only do you hope that your stocks have some form of intrinsic value, but you hope that there'll be a certain yield. I mean, there's difference. There's what they call preference stocks, or what's the right word?
Preferred stocks.
Thank you. Preferred stocks. I try to read the Wall Street Journal section B when I can. So there's the preferred stocks, which actually, you know, are more likely to give you money, but don't really give you the voting decision. So the issue with that is that you, let's say you put in $60, and then you still have, you know, $60 worth, but you also have a yield. So that yield should constitute some form of ribis, because you essentially are giving the person some sort of loan in order to build up the company. And now not only do you have $60 in theory, even though it's not liquid per se, but you are making more money off it.
With stock, it is an ownership interest in the company. And so the value of your ownership interest can shift based upon the profits made by the company or the outlook of the company. So it's not a loan. There can't be interest. It's investment. It's ownership.
Right. No, absolutely. You know, heterisk is definitely, and you know, it's a good topic for myself to review as well. It's definitely worthy maybe of a future share that we should do. But I didn't come to share tonight. Regrettably, I didn't come prepared with all the material on this. So I'm not prepared to get into the details, but I see that there is great interest in this topic. That was not intentional. Great interest in this topic.
But again, as a common law attorney, what I'm looking at is what I learned in law school constitutes ownership. And it's analogous to a can of pickup sticks. If you have all the pickup sticks, you own the whole thing. But each pickup stick represents an aspect of ownership. And if you don't have all of the pickup sticks, you don't fully own. So if you can be required to sell the property back for what you paid for it, you don't have all the indices of ownership.
Right. So it's interesting. I mean, again, without having material on the tips of my fingers, this actually comes up not just from a financial standpoint halachically, but this actually comes to a head before Pesach. Let's say you invested in, I don't know, Nestle, right? Or is Nestle a parent company, or is it owned by someone? It's a parent company. Okay. I don't know. You invested in Coca-Cola. You invest in one of those major companies. So the issue is you have to sell your stock before Pesach. So the general assumption is that your stock is not really considered real ownership unless you have enough stock that actually gives you voting rights for the company. Once you have voting rights for the company, then you're considered to have actual ownership because you have rights to determining its future. So there might be a difference in terms of what we call ownership from that standpoint. It comes up in Hilchos Pesach. Anyway, very good discussion. Very worthy of a shiur into itself. Judd, I know you're waiting patiently here. You can go and then we'll continue.
Is there any accounting for improvements that were made by the buyer that are now ripped away from him?
So you're saying what if there's like inflation or deflation or?
No, he could, painting, mm-hmm. fixing windows, he makes improvements to the property, and then it's taken away from him. And he's lost money.
In the end of Bava Kama, there's some Mishnayos about that, I think, right?
I think Henry's right. And, like, you know, let's say there's not, I think it's even cases that come up in terms of where you didn't really ask for the help, but the guy came and improved it anyway. And do you owe the person money for those? So, yeah. Okay. I know there was a suggestion put out. I don't know if the individual wanted to remain anonymous or not. that our next Masechta, our next Gemara that we do, should be in Seder Nezikin, something that deals more directly with financial matters from a Talmudic standpoint. So I, in general, I'm going to put together a list of two or three potential next Masechtos for us. But of course, rather than me just come up with them on my own, if you feel very strongly one way or about another Masechta, please suggest it. I know this makes it hard for Seder Nezikin for the Masechtas people want to do, but you know, we can keep it under 60 blog. That's probably advisable. But I realize that severely limits us. But okay, to be discussed. Okay, anyway, let's get into the case, right? Let's just reorient ourselves. Again, Reuven sells a shul to Shimon. Reuven now demands it back. Shimon, in return, gets his original $1 million plus 3 months of rent. Isn't that considered ribbis? Well, Rabbi Yochanan suggests that Rabbi Meir, it holds like Rabbi Yehuda, who suggests Sad Echav Ribbis Mutter, since there's only a chance that it might lead to ribbis, this doesn't constitute a problem of ribbis. And where do we see this opinion of Rabbi Yehuda? In the following Braisa, the Tanya. So if Reuven, similar kind of case, Reuven lends, it's interesting, here it's, well, here's more classic case, he's not buying, he's lending a mana to Shimon, and so that he's lending money to Shimon, and Shimon gives as security, as collateral, he gives his field to for Reuven to hold on to in the meantime. So the question is, can Reuven, it's a vineyard, let's say, can he pluck grapes from the field in the meantime? Can he benefit from it? So certainly the first opinion is, Bizman Shemocher Ochopiris Mutter, Lokiach Ochopiris Aser. It's funny, the terminology that's being used here can be a little bit confusing. When the mocher, is the seller is eating the fruits, meaning the person who gave his field as collateral, we're calling him the seller, he's really the borrower, so I know the terms are a little confusing. Shimon, right? So Shimon, who gives the field as collateral, is certainly allowed to eat from the fruit of his own field, but lokeach ochopiros aser. However, the opinion of the Tana Kama, the first opinion, is that even though Reuven is holding onto the field as a security, he still is not allowed to benefit from the fruits of the field. He's just supposed to hold on to it. In the event that the loan defaults and he's not able to pay it back, so then he could take the field for himself. But he's not allowed to benefit from it in the interim. However, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, afilu lokeach ocho peros mutter, Rabbi Yehuda says, even the person, Reuven, who is merely watching the field, holding on to it as collateral in the meantime, he would be allowed to actually eat from the fruits of the field. Even though in the event that the field is indeed returned and he gets his money back, he gets the loan back, so then what would happen? He would get the same amount of money back, plus he would get all those fruits that he ate in the interim, which would be interest. However, there's a chance that the loan will default and he will be able to own that field anyway, in which case it's his field, so it's not interest because he didn't get his money back. It's like a sale. So Rayhuda's okay with the lender eating from the field in the interim because there's only a chance that it might constitute ribbis. And that's not enough for it to constitute ribbis, according to Rayhuda. Rayhuda says, and how do I know this is true? The bite to spend zoning just today of Mecher Api Rebelos Ben Azaria, Lokeh Hoka Perosaya. This is precisely what happened under the guidance of Rebelos Ben Azaria, that Reuven the lender, who was holding onto the field as collateral, was permitted to eat from it in the interim. However, not everyone agrees on how the story went down. Umrlo, the sages respond, Misham Raya? Mocher Hoka Perosaya, Lolokeh. You're mixing up your facts. Actually, it was just the guy who actually owns the field, who the borrower who gave the field as collateral, he was the only one eating from the field at the time. So don't make a bubba mises to support your position, they say. My Benayu, point being is, what is the root of their disputation. Their dispute is, as we explained, whether the chance of there being ribis makes it ribis. Mar sovereign tzadech of a ribis mutter, mar sovereign tzadech of a ribis usser. We saw the position of Rabbi Yehuda is that only a chance of ribis would not be problematic, which, why do we bring this all in? Which is why Rabbi Meir is fine with Reuven selling a shul to Shimon and demanding it back, even though there's a chance that Shimon winds up at the end of the day with the same $1 million plus 3 months of free rent. That's one way to look at it. Rava Amar, Sad Echa Baribis Aser. No. Everyone holds that if there's a chance, even a chance of ribis, it's going to count as ribis. It's interest. Too bad. What's going on here in this dispute between Rabbi Huna and Tanakama? Bahacha ribis amenasa haxer ikabinayu. Mar savar ribis amenasa haxer mutter, mar savar aser. What's their dispute? Everyone agrees that in the event that Shimon, who is taking a loan from Reuven, if Shimon actually pays up the loan, meaning he returns the money in full to Reuven, and Reuven now has to return the field, not only does Reuven have to return the field, if he chose to eat fruit from it in the interim, he would have to compensate Shimon accordingly for any benefit he derived from the field in the interim. In other words, there would be no ribis. The only question is, in theory, while Reuven is eating from the field, it might be considered like interest at the time, even though down the line he's going to pay for it. So the question is one allowed to kind of derive a form of ribis at the moment, even though he plans on paying back later? That's a more limited scope of dispute. And if you look at Tosfos says, or Rabbi Meir Demasni, he says this is what according to Rava, that's Rabbi Meir's position in the Mishnah, that when one sells a shul to another person and then demands it back, the original buyer of the shul will actually also, in addition to the $1 million, tag on a few thousand dollars worth of rent from the previous months that he was using the shul. So that would be two ways of looking at it. So basically what comes out of the end of Gemara is that there are two ways to interpret Rabbi Meir. Either Rabbi Meir says that the guy gets 3 months of rent and returns the shul, and we don't call it ribis, or Enachinami, he returns the shul when it's requested of him, but he also is paying for the few months of rent that he had, so there is no interest in the end of the day anyway. Okay, that wraps up our discussion of ribis. I could see that there was a lot of interest in this kind of topic, and it gets me thinking about maybe kind of other folks are interested in these kind of topics as well. So I'll put it out there on a upcoming survey, God willing.
Now, there's something else that interests me while you're discussing it. A lot depends, I would think, on when the loan is due in relationship to when the crop is going to ripen. Because I can see if the borrower can't access the crop because he doesn't have the field, and the lender can't access the crop because he might be getting interest, the crop's going to sit there and rot, and that doesn't seem to benefit anybody.
That is a fair point. What this brings us to is a separate discussion, not separate, but related discussion, which also is a very important Seder Zikin topic, which is, what do you call it? Why am I blanking? Basically, there's a discussion where that comes up in, was it Bava Kamma, somewhere towards the beginning. Did we talk about in Makos? Essentially, there could be an idea where you rent, where someone's like has an apartment that's remaining idle and nobody is using it anyway. And the question is, if I, you know, squat and I just use their apartment and I'm not causing any damage to it, I'm just sitting in there, So zenenev zelo chaser. Thank God, how I blanked out on that. Zakasa zenenev zelo chaser, where I benefit and you don't lose out. So is that something that you can charge me for, where I benefited from you, but you didn't lose out on anything? You know, you have a flame and I warm myself by the flame. So I benefited from the flame, but you didn't lose anything. So, you know, I don't have to pay you restitution. You didn't lose anything. But on the other hand, I benefited from something that you have. So what do you do in a case like that? So very relevant. Zenenev zelo chaser, very relevant for a discussion. I don't know. Let's say I log onto someone's Wi-Fi to use it. In theory, they're, you know, when you go on a plane, for instance, you could pay for Wi-Fi or you could pay for an upgraded Wi-Fi. So there is a certain worth to internet access. So should you be, but, you know, if I'm not using my Wi-Fi, no one's losing out if you use it. Okay. Very relevant.
About that once Shabbos afternoon, I think.
What was that?
You talked about that Wi-Fi issue, but, you know, using somebody else's Wi-Fi.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know what? I think we did it maybe Rosh Hashanah even.
Yeah, maybe about a year ago.
Yeah, yeah. Last Jewish year, you know. very good. Very okay. Thank you for reminding me. It's always good to know you.
You have notes.
Yeah, yeah.
Just paying attention.
Just so long as, like, I know somebody actually remembers it, it means I can't repurpose it yet. Yeah. All right. Let's cover some ground, guys. It's 7:37. I will ask. I know we have so many thoughts and such good discussion. I'll ask that you give me about 10 minutes or so we can make some more progress in the Gemara. And God willing, when we wrap it up, we'll open up for some more questions. Here we go. The good news is that was the difficult part for tonight. So if you are still with us, it'll be smooth sailing from here, God willing. So remember, the rabbis were okay selling a shul, and no one could demand it back. That was just Rabbi Meir's own idiosyncrasy. However, they said, provided that the shul is not sold for something that would be undignified. All right, Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Related to this matter, one is allowed to relieve themselves, to urinate in a place within four amos, within about 6 feet of where they davened. Amarav Yosef, Mike Mashmalan, why did you tell me that? I can infer that from the Mishnah itself. Tanina, Yehuda Omer, according to Rabbi Yehuda, I can sell a shul, not, and I don't have to stipulate what it's going to be used for. The shul could be used even for something undignified, according to Rabbi Yehuda. So, and by Pilar Rabbanan, and even according to Rabbanan, who are more strict than Rabbi Yehuda, and said a shul cannot be turned into something undignified. They only limited to a Beis HaKnesses, a shul, which, as we've established time and time again, has inherent kedusha to it. But the four amos, you know, if I'm just going on vacation and in the middle of a hike, I decide to daven mincha here, it doesn't imbue this place with any sanctity. So if I'm done davening here and, you know, I'm on a hike, I'm on the side, and I need to relieve myself, there's nothing stopping me from using this place also. So there's no particular novelty to his statement that I couldn't infer from the Mishnah. On this topic, Tani Tana Kamedur Rav Nachman. So now we're going to learn a brisa. Here we go. Hamispalo marchik dalad amos umashtin. Vamashtin marchik dalad amos umispalo. Someone who's davening and needs to relieve themselves, they should distance themselves four amos from where they were davening. Vamashtin and someone who relieves themselves marchik dalad amos umispalo, they should then distance themselves four amos and daven. Amarle. I understand that someone who relieves themselves then distance themselves four amos in order to daven. After all, Tanina, this is from Brachos. Okay, I guess I could have guessed that. Kama yarchik mehem umin hatsoa dalad amos, because it says explicitly in the Mishnah and Brachos that one should distance themselves from urine and from feces four amos before davening. But why, just because you were once davening here, do you then need to distance yourself for amos from where you're davening before you relieve yourself? Because by that logic, all the pathways of Nahar Da it would be usher for one to take a pit stop, because it's, you know, there's so many rabbanim, so many people, not just rabbanim, so many Jews who are going down these paths, who are davening, who are learning. It should be usher to go to the restroom anywhere in the Hardah. Because at some point in time, presumably somebody was davening in this spot. So clearly we don't sanctify the place that we have an ad hoc davening session. So, and if you remember, this harkens back to our discussion about the Rechovo Shel Ha'ir, the street in the city, where on occasion we would come out during the fast days when we're praying for rain, there would be an ad hoc service in the temple, in the village square. But there's no residual Kedusha afterwards. You could set up your shops and do whatever you want after. So rather, it's not that you have to distance yourself actively, Dala Amos, Tony Yishvat. It means you should wait the amount of time that it takes to wait for Amos. You should wait a few moments before you proceed. So, meaning you should wait. Let's say you're davening, you wait the amount of time it takes to walk for Amos before relieving yourself. And if you relieve yourself, you wait a few moments, the amount of time it takes to walk for Amos, before you go ahead and you resume or proceed to daven. So, Bishlama, let's try to understand this. I understand. I understand why if someone relieves themselves, you forgive me for being graphic, I'm just trying to help you understand the Gemara, there's could be additional droplets still. So, you know, therefore it's very practical that one should wait a few moments before proceeding to daven. Why should someone who's davening but then needs to relieve themselves, why should they have to wait? Why should they have to wait a few moments? If they're done davening, they're done davening. The moment they're done davening, let them go ahead and do whatever else they need to. Because even after you think you're done davening, the davening is still a little bit on your mind, hopefully. The words are still fading from your mouth. And therefore, it is appropriate to wait a few moments before jumping from having the name of God in your mouth to then jumping to performing bodily functions. And I think that's something that's probably rather intuitive to us. So there you have it. Okay. Apropos of this discussion, we're now at the final section. We're going to talk about special practices that the sages had that they believe gave them longevity of life. One of the practices is that someone is very careful about when they daven and they relieve themselves. And that's kind of the transition of how we segue from this discussion to that discussion. Here we go. Shalom Tamidavis Rebbe Zakkai. B'mai Arachli Yamin. They asked Rebbe Zakkai, what gave you such long length of days? Amar Lahem. Mimai lo hishtati mayim b'sech da'amos shel tefila. I never relieved myself within 4 amos of where I daven. I mean, not only did he wait Dalad Amos, but he didn't even relieve himself within the proximity of where he had davened, which is, I believe, a special practice for him, but I believe it's accepted as standard practice as well. Again, this is a time where they didn't have like designated restrooms, so you have to understand why it's not as patently obvious as it is to you and me. Velo kinisi l'chaverai, I never called my friend a nickname. Tosfos points out that we already know that it is forbidden to call somebody based on the Gemara Baba Metzia. Remember, we had a discussion about Nas Mar, political correctness, all that fun stuff. So in that discussion, we mentioned that one's not allowed to call someone by a pejorative nickname. His special Hanhaga Tova was that he was so careful, he didn't call anyone by any nicknames. And I think Marissa was telling me, like, she had some from co-worker someone, and basically they were mocked not to call their kids by any nicknames. And it was like a firmer community. So apparently it's like a thing in the firmer like Jewish communities, but also it's like a Southern thing to give people double names and call them by double names, you know, like Mary Lou. And so, you know,
I think so.
Yeah. You know, so like in the Jewish community also, like, you know, we, was about to give names of our relatives, but I didn't think it's on her side of the family, so I don't think she'd appreciate it. Great, say, Raymond, what do we have? We got Bar Salman, right? We got
Bar Salman, yeah. Bar Salman, there's
a thing. Right, so it's a thing. So they were like, because they're very mock and not to even like sound coming close to the nickname, they always call their kid by their double name. That was their shtick. Apparently, it's derived from this Gemara. I also never neglected to make Kiddush Hayom. I want to take a moment just to appreciate this, even though I know we're kind of time crunch. I always made sure to be careful to make Kiddush during the daytime of Shabbos on wine. This is super, sorry, I just saw a weird message. Let me disable WhatsApp on my background. That's the popping you keep hearing, which is distracting me. Sorry for me. Let me just turn it off. Okay, thank you for your patience. Kiddush Hayom, some of you I know are in a Sefer Chinuch shiur, so as we learned, it's a rabbinical mitzvah. You're not even feeling anything on a Doraisa level. And on top of that, Kiddush Hayom, we've mentioned, it's just like a quick Borei Pri Agafa, nothing special. You could have Chamar Medina instead. But, you know, look at the extent that these rabbis went out of their way to ensure that they had wine, even just for Kiddush Hayom. And then ask yourselves when you're at Kiddush next time, you know, if you don't plan on making Kiddush on wine, why we're not doing that. So here we go. Zoom is the king of Italy. He said, I had an elderly mother. She sold her, it means like a covering of the head, but it's presumably not referring to her head covering, but it's like a veil or something that's not actually covering her hair. And she sold it in order so that I would have money to afford wine for Kiddush. Tana, and they talk, when she died, she bequeathed to him 300 barrels of wine. Pretty impressive. I only have one bottle of wine sitting in our house. I have nowhere near that. And when he died, he increased it to 3,000 barrels of wine he left for his kids. So clearly there were no drinking issues in his family. Rav Huna, okay, so look at the extent they go for wine. Rav Huna hava asar risa. Rav Huna came in, he was wearing some sort of like, you know, grass on him or something. He didn't seem he could afford proper clothing. He came before Rav. Amarle, Rav says to him, my hi, what's going on with you? Why are you dressed properly? Amarle, lahavli kiddusha, I didn't have enough money to afford wine for Kiddush. So I sold my belt in order to afford money to buy wine for Kiddush. The Kali Kabi the Rav. And so when he came before Rav, Amarle, oh sorry, no, I just went back, my mistake. Amarle, Yehe Rava de Situm Bishirai. May be God's will that one day, because of your righteousness, one day you will be covered in fine silk. Okay, one day, ki ichlau. When his son Rabba was going into the chuppah, Rashi says, to get married. Clearly, he must have expended a lot of money on this. Rav Huna, ish gutzahava, apparently he was a short guy, in Gana Aporia, he was laying on his bed. Asiyam bante kalase, shokhan shayminai alai, adi itum bishrai. They threw their garments of silk upon him, until he was fully covered in them. In other words, he was able to ensure that they had proper silk, and apparently there was excess silk, and they threw it on him as well. And so he was blessed to have not just posterity, but also that the posterity were secure financially. Shamarav, so now we can end the story here and say, wow, this is such a beautiful story, happy ending. But we don't always go with the happy endings, right? Shamarav, the Ikbid. Rav, remember Rav, he's the one who gave the blessing that he should get fine silk. So how do you think Rav feels about this? Like, he might be happy for him, but also Ikbid, Big Bid, he was upset. Why? Omar, my time of Omarti li kibrachticha bechein lemar. Why? Clearly, Rashi points out, it was an Ace Rod zone. Clearly, my blessing was effective enough to bring you financial security and wealth. So why can you not respond when I ask you, Bechei Lamar, and so may it be for you as well. So I too could have reaped the blessing that I gave to you. So you have said it in for that. By the way, that's a response. Someone gives you a blessing and you're not sure what to, you know, you say, thank you, thank you. You say, Bechei Lamar, and so may it be for you. That's a proper Jewish response to when someone gives a blessing. Good concept, good phrase to know. Bechei Lamar. And I guess Bechei Lamaras for a woman. Okay. Finally, what did you do, Rabbi Elazar ben Shmuel, that you had length of days? Another important concept. I never use a shul as a shortcut. That's a, it was a big challenge in the chapel. People would cut through the chapel to go out the emergency exit door. Now it's marked as emergency exit door, and hopefully people abide by it for that reason also. But it was an issue that people would just go through the chapel and out the shul, but you're not supposed to use the shul as, in particular, the chapel, the sanctuary, rooms that are designated for prayer, one should not use it as a shortcut. Velo pisati al roshe kadosh. I wouldn't step over the heads of members of our holy nation. They would sit on the floor back then, and it might be easier. You know, you're in the movies, you're trying to go in, so you step over the person to get out. So he never did that. I was always told as a kid, like, you know, don't step over anyone because then it'll stunt their growth and it'll do this and that. I don't know. Maybe this is where they got it from. Lo nisati kapai b'lo bracha. And also, I never made a blessing when duchening. When saying Birchas Kohanim, I always made sure to recite a bracha beforehand. Once again, one way to understand it is just that he was makbid on this mitzvah. He was very careful. I think we live in a post-Talmudic era where this is just standard practice. You have to remember, back in times of the Gemara, they were still forming some of these ideas. These are the people who are in Shas itself, so they didn't own their own Gemaras to read. These are the people who are in the Gemara. So some practices that are recorded in the Gemara, I think, were not as widespread during the times of the Gemara yet, because Shas was not published. So another, you know, you see in other Gemaras, like in Brachos, that making a bracha on the Torah, we talked about this a few weeks ago, making a bracha before reading the Torah wasn't as obvious to people also, even though that's standard practice today. So again, things that are standard today weren't as obvious back then, so they were considered pious practices. Finally, now we're actually finally. What did you do? I prayed, you got to extend your days. I always made to shul first. So he was the rabbi, so he wanted to make it to shul before everyone else did. It makes a good impression. I try to do that when I can. I also try to, you know, help out at home sometimes, right, Marissa? So, you know, it doesn't always help with getting to shul particularly early, but I do try to get there on time. I never led benching, or back then, the guy didn't just make the zim when he actually recited benching out loud. Everyone listened through Shamea Ka'onat. So I never led benching when there was a Kohen present. I gave it to the Kohen, right, Zaini? And I never ate from an animal in which the matanos, the gifts that are meant for the Kohen, were not separated. It's referring to the foreleg, the chai and the cheeks, jaw area, and the cave of the stomach, Rashi says. That's the position of Rabbi Yitzchak, apparently, that it's like tevel if someone doesn't separate these things from the animal before eating. However, if you're worrying about this, you shouldn't be worrying about this. We don't pass him like that. So in case you own any cows, don't worry. Finally, the Gemara questions, you never led benching in the presence of a Kohen. You say that as if that's a good thing. But remember, you are a Talmud Chacham, you're a Torah scholar. So the question is, when you have a Kohen and a Torah scholar, who trumps whom? The Hamar of Yochanan, Kol Talmud Chacham Shemavarech Lefana Vafilu Kohen Gadol Am HaAretz, Osa Talmud Chacham Chayev Misa. That Basically, I mean, it's hyperbole, presumably. I don't think they're actually putting the Torah scholar to death over it, but a Torah scholar should be taking precedence over a Kohen Gadol who is not a Torah scholar, who doesn't know any Torah, because you're not simply honoring the Torah scholar, you're honoring the Torah that they possess. It's Kavod HaTorah. Shenemar, Tomatanai Avu Mavet, it says, all those who despise me love death. That's God speaking. Don't read that as those who hate but despise, but those who cause others to despise me. So the question is, Rabbi Yitzchak, why is that so special that there were Kohanim who always led in your presence? If you're a big Talmud Chacham, really you should have led benching. So the answer is, Kika'amar Ibishavim. What's the case that we're criticizing Talmud Chacham? When there's no when there isn't a Kohen of equal stature. Clearly, if you have Talmud Chacham A, Talmud Chacham B, but Talmud Chacham B is also an addition of Kohen, that would outweigh the scale, and he should lead benching. Now, Tosa says, well, what's the Chiddush then? Who cares? What's the Gemara informing me then? The answer he says is that if you have two Talmud Chachamim, you know, this guy mastered, you know, X amount of Masechtos, this guy, you know, did a little bit less. We don't take out our yardstick to figure out, you know, who's the bigger Talmud Chacham. If they're both knowledgeable Torah people, we defer to the one who's a Kohen. If it's clear, you know, we have to start thinking about who knows more. We don't start playing that game. Standard practice nowadays is that we just defer to the Kohen. However, this wasn't always obvious. I think even during times where we showed him, it wasn't obvious at that point. There's a Chu of the Rashba, I believe, that deals with that's important for this discussion. Anyway. It's 7:57 with hardly any time to spare. Because officially we end tonight. I want to thank you all for joining. Again, just a reminder, folks who join us for Sunday, Monday, Marissa and I are going to be away this weekend starting tomorrow morning through Monday. So there's no Sunday or Monday shear, but there will, God willing, be Thursday shear next week. So wishing you all a good Shabbos, Freilich and Chanukah. And God willing, once I get more details, I will email them out to you about the CM. All right?
Thank you, Rabbi.
All right.
Good job, everybody.
Good job.
Good
job.